And we're back. This is Drawn to Scale, and I'm your host, Sun. It's been about a month, and I'm back with a vengeance. You know, I'm really excited for this interview tonight, today. I guess it is nighttime somewhere in the world. My guest is none other than Joshua Okon. And for the summer, it's going to be a exciting themed summer. The theme is family. In July, we have the husband and wife pair of Joshua Astor and Kristen Calabrese. They're Los Angeles-based painters. In August, we have Jai Tip and Jom Jai, gallerists in Chinatown. They run a space called Jai and Jai. And then in September, we have the Art Bros, three guys that talk about art and post their, you know, musings on YouTube. So it's Mike, Fancy Dave, and Patrick of Art Bros in September. All right, so, you know, I was trying to explain this game that I wanted to play with Joshua earlier during our sound check. I just made it up before coming into the studio station. Is this called a studio or a station, Don?
You're in the studio broadcasting from the station.
Oh, okay. I'm in the studio broadcasting from the station. it's called Name That Chimera. And, you know, I think most people know what a chimera is. I guess it's like you would describe a dragon as like a chimera. It's like a mixture of all these animals. You would call like a sphinx a chimera, maybe. But okay, so why don't I just give an example? What would you call a mixture of a goat and a spider? Name that chimera. Anybody?
No. Goat and a spider. Spy goat.
That's a good one, I guess.
A goiter?
A goiter? Yeah. I didn't think of that one. That's a good one.
That's a good one. I like it better.
Yeah. I was thinking either spout or like goiter or something, but goiter is probably the best. All right, Joshua, how about this? What would you call a dog mixed with a cat?
Dog and a cat. A cattle.
A cattle?
Cattle. C-A-T-O.
Oh, okay.
No, I guess
not. I mean, you're playing the Mexican version of the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? okay, so guys, this...
I don't know.
You don't know? Okay, I think that's the end of the game.
Okay.
It kind of sucks.
Good game, though.
Good game? Okay. All right. Maybe we'll play for some money later. See who can name the best chimera. But for now, the voice you're hearing is Joshua Okon. I'm going to go ahead and read a brief introduction here. This is off of the Moore Charpentier Gallery website, but it's not, you know, all-encompassing. I think there's probably a more substantial, you know, description out there somewhere. The artist, Joshua, blends mediums. Are you okay there?
Yeah, yeah, I'm good.
Okay.
I was just moving a little bit, but I'm good.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You're like we're moving furniture or something. The artist blends mediums, including video, installation, and performance, in order to engage the viewer in a dialogue concerning the complexity of contemporary society. Period. His work can be apprehended like a series of near sociological experiments, humorous provocations, blending staged situations, documentation, and improvisation, in order to question the usual perceptions of reality and truth, individuality, and morality. Period. People, I'd like to welcome Joshua to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
How did you like that intro? Did it fit your... do you like it?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Thank you.
Can you tell...
good intro.
Somebody wrote it. It must have been the gallery person, I assume.
I think so, yes.
So, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, thank you.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. We are on Skype right now. And I'm in Los Angeles. Joshua's... You're...
Mexico City.
Yeah. Woot woot.
Ooh.
Es muy caliente en Mexico, la ciudad de Mexico.
This is rain season began already, so it's fresh. The hot part of the year is the spring.
Oh, really?
So now we're kind of already freshened up. Like,
yeah.
June it freshens up, so it's not bad.
Yeah, things are like green and flourishing and stuff like that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a very nice time of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Cool. What part of Mexico City are you in? Is it?
Sorry?
What part of Mexico City are you in?
It's a very central neighborhood called Condesa.
Condesa.
And that's where I grew up.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You mean like you're living and working like where, like?
My house is in Condesa, and my studio is really close to my house.
Yeah.
And it's in a neighborhood called Roma. So it's the kind of a neighboring neighborhood from Condesa.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Roma, mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's, you know, it's weird because Los Angeles has Venice, and there's like these like weird like European named, you know, cities.
Yes, Italy. We all love Italy.
They've spread their influence quite broadly, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. You know, I just found out that you taught at UCSD, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I was there from 1999 to 2003.
Oh, great.
Were you
did your undergrad there?
Yeah, I did my undergrad there.
So you were 1999 to 2003?
99, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because I taught there, I think, 2003 to 2007.
Oh, so like right after I left.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a great program.
It's really good. Yeah, I really like teaching there.
Yeah. Did you have like your, did they give you like a studio there? Like in that building? You know what I'm talking about?
No, because I was visiting faculty.
Like adjunct.
But they kept, adjunct, exactly. But they kept hiring me every year, so I kept going back. So, I lived in LA at the time, so I commuted to UCSD. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Give me an example of a class you taught.
One of the classes I taught for undergrads was a video class, which I really liked, and for which the students had to do a video every week. So there were like different themes every week, and then they had to make a video, and then in class we would look at the videos and discuss them. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Wow. I imagine if I was a student in that class, I would kind of just freak out because it sounds like you would be a really rigorous program.
No, the other way around. It was a fun class.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was about, you know, making videos about the things that the students were interested in. So I think, yeah, it wasn't that strict. I mean, it was strict, but fun.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Sure. So
yes.
Cool. I'm glad that we have that kind of, I don't know, location connection. Shall we jump into the meat of our discussion with the first question? Are you ready,
yeah,
Joshua?
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh,
okay.
I'm ready.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Okay. First question. Do you consider yourself a dissident? And how does dissident... I think I spelled that wrong. Dissonance? How does dissidence figure into an art practice? That's a two-part question.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm a dissident, but I definitely find myself constantly disagreeing with many aspects of our current like mainstream culture. For instance, I think that the current model of capitalism based in consumption is completely unsustainable and is heading for disaster at a very fast speed. I think we're doing a terrible job administrating our resources.
Sure.
So I think, you know, as a sensitive human being, I cannot help but to worry about that. You know, and, you know, of course, that ends up finding a way into my art practice. You know, I don't think, you know, the way I feel about the world around me is separated from my practice. I think art is necessarily connected to to our sensibilities and to our worldview. And, you know, the moment that stops happening and the moment we lose agency in our practice, I think it's the moment that, it stops being art, you know, it becomes something else.
There's this really poignant video that you made, and it took place at a McDonald's that, uh-huh. I mean, when you, you know, when you're telling me about capitalism, et cetera, that piece is like a very striking, like, can you explain briefly what you did with that
yeah,
piece?
Sure.
Because that makes sense, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that piece, it's actually called Freedom Fries. and it's a piece for which I shot it here in Mexico City, and I talked the manager of a McDonald's to let me shoot, like have the location overnight for a shoot. So finally, you know, convince him and brave him into letting me do it. And then I, you know, before going to shoot, I sat at the McDonald's. All I could get was there a coffee because everything else is really
bad.
Well,
yeah.
The coffee was terrible as well. But and then just waited for a customer to come in that I could ask to be the model for the video. So eventually, you know, a lady with her kids came in, and then I asked her if she wanted to be a model. So in the end, the video it's very, very simple. It's a kind of almost like a painting. You know, there's hardly any movement. So
yeah.
It's basically this.
It's almost like a still life.
Almost like a still life. That's it.
Yeah.
Yes. And so it's a portrait of this frequent. How you call that in English? The someone that goes a lot to a in Spanish it's called cliente frequente, like a regular
a regular yeah, yeah
yeah
exactly. If you fly if you fly it's like a frequent flyer, but
yeah,
if you dine at some restaurant often
it's a regular. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was translating from Spanish. so anyway, so she's just like laying on a table, and then all you could see in terms of movement, it's her breathing. And then through the window, you can see a kid, you know, cleaning the window. So, anyway, so it's almost like a still life. And I remember presenting that piece in a big screen, and a lot of people at first glance thought it was like still, and then they realized it was this movement like far in the back.
Yeah. Is somebody washing the windows? Like one of the workers?
Yeah, there's a kid. watching the window from the outside with the M. So anyway, I mean, in Mexico, there's a huge epidemic right now of obesity. You know, as junk food kind of moved in, and this whole corporate model of industrialized food and
sure.
So that completely changed the eating habits here, especially for people, low-income people, and that created a huge obesity epidemic and therefore a huge diabetes epidemic.
Yeah, just one problem leading to the next. And you kind of see the symptoms. The symptoms are just like thrown right in, it's glaring.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, this show, this radio show, is primarily a Los Angeles show. And I know you lived here and you went to school here too. Mm-hmm. But it seems like there are problems here that happen in our neighboring countries, like more and more.
Right. Yeah, well, it's a model and a system that has been expanding. You know, a whole neoliberal capitalism is really spreading fast and reaching more and more corners, and it's completely dismantling traditional ways of living and replacing them with this literal junk.
Yeah, I mean, Joshua is I really kind of have to commend him, because I don't think there are enough artists that make this kind of work. And it's really applaudable.
Thank you.
Okay, so should we go on to the next question?
Sure.
In general, would you agree that art is a conversation, like what we're doing now? If so, what kind is it, and how does it go beyond talking, other methods of communication like reading and writing? Can you think of a good example? And when it comes to discourse, do you think agreement or differing opinions fuel discourse? So this is a three-part question.
Okay. Well, yes, definitely. I think art is a conversation. But I think that conversation can happen in many ways. I don't think, there are any rules. In my case, I always hope to implicate the viewer in what they are watching. I mean, when they encounter my work, and to break the distance between the issues that are being addressed in the work and their own personal experience, their own personal everyday experiences. So when that happens, I think people are engaged and they begin a process of rethinking their previous notions or their previous ideas. That doesn't mean that anyone has to agree, but that process in itself of rethinking, previous notions is what interests me.
Yeah.
And I think that's what fuels, conversations, that can take place at the moment or later. And that also fuels, discourse and engagement in general.
Yeah, because your audience is, I assume they're informed to some degree, and and you're not just giving information. This is something that is like in addition to information. This is something that you can actually feel and maybe associate with it somehow in your personal life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the work, I think, operates in different levels. And then one level might be information, but there's also like a phenomenological encounter to the work. And there are other, strategies that I use so that when you encounter it, you're kind of stimulated into thinking and into rethinking a lot of your ideas about the world or about the issues that are being addressed in the work. I try to make works that stimulate this process I just described, and not works that have a closed or predefined perspective or point of view.
Yeah, it's a kind of taking an alternative, perhaps, or
I'm not sure of alternatives, but I think we inherit a lot of the ways we relate to the ways we think about the world. I think we highly live based in conventions and things we learned. So I think art has this amazing possibility of allowing us to like step back a little bit and to rethink or to formulate for the first time ideas about what's around us. We tend to not really have this process in our everyday life. We kind of things are so normal that in the everyday life we just keep going without sometimes stepping back and thinking.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I got into the art game in the beginning, was because I wanted to question everything rather than, you know, be just thrown these ideas that I'm forced to believe in.
Yeah, exactly. Or the ideas that corporate media is constantly pushing on us.
Yeah. What are some of the myths that art and artists have today that should be either dispelled or kept, given the many different kinds of art and artists? Is it even possible to have, let's say, a stereotypical artist, like, you know, a drunk painter,
There's a stereotype in France that there's even a saying that refers to the dumb painter. You know, the painter is someone that it's just emotions and doesn't think.
Yeah, like just all just like painting strokes with brute force.
Yeah. Well, of course, I don't think all artists understand art in the same way, and it's I think there's a lot of diversity. But I think there are many aspects. Especially market-oriented aspects, which are conditioning and are kind of homogenizing in many levels what takes place and how many artists are working, in their approach. For instance, I think that the huge and disproportionate predominance and influence of art fairs, which in my opinion offer very limited possibilities of what art can be and how art can be experienced.
Yeah.
Are definitely shaping many artists in ways that I don't think are very positive for their practice or for culture in general.
Yeah.
Attention span in art first is very short, just a few seconds in average. So how can there be space for any kind of depth or reflexivity in such a context? And unfortunately, many artists are mainly producing for such a fragmented environment.
Yeah, I agree.
And end up making work that is all about surface, and that brings, I think, art to its kind of lowest denominator. I think, you know, art has a possibility of being a lot more complex than that.
Yeah, because when I think of, let's say, artists, some of my favorite artists from, Central America and South America, I think of, and you're probably familiar with them, Miguel Angel Rios, and Santiago Serra. You know, these guys kind of, I don't know if they necessarily broke the mold, but they kind of like took the mold and just like, you know, gave it like new, they just like breathe new life into it, so to speak.
Yeah, I think, I mean, both of them are really, really great artists that I also admire a lot. And I think, yeah, they're artists that are highly creative and highly working in their own terms, and you know, with their own kind of agency. So they're both very free as artists, and I think the work really reflects that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Your work, it plays within liminal spaces, like how we talked about Freedom Fries. Can you describe what that is? Maybe provide a textual reference or an example from your own body of work?
Again, can you maybe rephrase that question to make sure I understand what do you mean?
Yeah. I guess what I mean by that...
What liminal spaces you have in mind when you think about my work?
Liminal spaces? I think that people who commute, they go through the subway and they see, let's say, a mosaic during their subway ride. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of like a liminal space, like an in-betweenness.
Yeah, no, but, I know what liminal means, but I, yeah.
But I don't know, Joshua. Maybe I'm asking you.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe you can define it.
I'm going to interpret it way I think. Because, I mean, for instance, one of the liminal spaces in my work has to do with, the place where like fiction and reality come together. Or in other words, this kind of very gray area there is always between fiction and reality.
Yeah.
And I am really highly interested in this space and this liminal space and the tension that this liminal space generates. So, you know, in general, in my practice, I work most of the time in real places or places that, they're not sets, but they're places that, in a way have an identity and a symbolism to them, and also with people that play themselves, that they don't become somebody else, but they kind of dive into a fiction as themselves.
Yeah.
And that I think creates this very interesting space. And somehow that kind of really as a viewer stimulates you into really trying to understand where that line is. I think we have that kind of tendency to try to understand, where this limit lays between fiction and reality. So I'm very much interested in this space.
Yeah, yeah. Now I think that makes a lot more sense. I was thinking, in addition to my first example, I grew up in Orange County, right? And so you have like mm-hmm. Disneyland, you have like, but there's also this place called the Wax Museum. I think it's closed now. I think they closed their doors and they sold off all their wax statues. But you know what I'm talking, right?
I've been to wax museums. I've never been to that one. So.
Right, right. Yes. It's all over the world, like Madame Sod's or whatever. It's also in Las Vegas too. But
there's one in Mexico City as well.
Yeah, they're like people who take pictures next to them as if, they were the real Marilyn Monroe, or if they were the real Michael Jordan, or you know what I mean?
Yes.
Is that a liminal space, do you think? I don't know. your heroes jumping off of the screen and coming to life, but then they're like static.
but in the photo it looks as if they're
yeah they're real with you. Yeah, but it's like made to be super realistic, so anyways,
yeah, now I want to go back to a wax museum. I have been into one for a long time.
What if you discovered, like, you walked into the one in Mexico City and you found out that there was a wax sculpture of you in it? Would you be freaked out, or would you be like...
But a melted one.
Just like a blob. Just like a Ken Price.
Like halfway melted.
All your limbs are just like... They just look like putty. Okay. So why don't we just go ahead and ask the next question.
Okay.
What do you feel about the recent spate of shootings in the U.S.? For example, Ferguson, Baltimore, white cops shooting young black men, and like the subsequent outrage and like this outpouring in the media. And can you shed light on some of the problems facing Mexico today that mm-hmm. receive media attention similar to, these?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I think, the U.S. is a police state. And on the other hand, there is a big neglect of big portions of society and a huge increase in poverty.
Yeah.
So if you put these two things together, you end up with the shootings that have been taking place. It does not surprise me at all. Having lived there for about 8 years, I know what police is like, and So, you know, social programs are being systematically eroded. The distribution of wealth keeps getting, you know, more and more uneven to proportions never experienced before in human history. You know, I was recently reading that the 300 richest men people in the world have the same amount of wealth as the 3,000 million poorest.
Jesus.
So, you know, it's crazy. You know, with these conditions, yeah. You know, what do you expect? You know, these things are expecting to happen. And, you know, I think, you know, the social fabric is being really destroyed, and the, you yeah. know, social programs are, like I said, are being eroded. And, you know, police brutality is not going to solve this. You know, it's not really a solution. So you know, we need institutions and a fair economic system for this yeah. to stop happening. And I think the answer of governments, you know, in the U.S. and here as well is brutality. You know, and you know, all I just say that also applies to Mexico, unfortunately. And you know, Mexico suffers from the same brutal and inhumane you know, neoliberal system.
Yeah.
That I think it's like a cancer that it's kind of spreading in our societies. And you know, also here, social and public institutions are being dismantled, and they are being replaced with state brutality. So you know, it's
like close to fascism almost.
It is. Yeah.
Do you think that you know, these protests, they do anything? Are they effective in kind of in engaging people in a way that could actually change, you know, this? Obviously, it's a systemic problem.
It is a systemic problem. Yeah. I mean, I think we are highly disempowered in these societies, and that's kind of part of the problem. But I think, you know, the protests do definitely help, but I don't think they help all that much. But you know, yeah. they do make a difference, but it's a small one.
Yeah. And as far as the work that artists make, political mm-hmm. like political artists, how does that engage in like a sort of way to change?
Yeah, well, I mean, it helps because, I mean, we are being dehumanized. You know, consumer society is about turning us into zombies, into like dehumanizing us, and in about taking our agency away. So, you know, I think making art is a way of regaining our agency, and engaging with art is a way of regaining that agency. So, you know, I don't see it as a solution by any means, but I think it does make a difference.
Cool. You know, Mexico, it has a rich history of art from all the way back to, am I getting this right? Were Mayans? They were like in the southern part of Mexico, right?
Mayans were also in Central America and south of Mexico, the Chiapas state of Mexico.
Yeah, and also you had also like Aztecs.
And the Aztecs were Mexico cities now. And, you know, they had an empire, so they kind of spread all around this. They even conquered the Mayans.
Yeah. Such a rich history, I think. But anyways, from the Mayans to the tradition of mural paintings that started in the 1920s, how do you think it has informed your work? And how does the reception differ between a Mexican and an American audience? I mean, specifically for you. And what about the European sensibility? Is there such a thing as a European sensibility, and has it reached across the globe, like, you know, to Asia and the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera? And what parts of it influence your way of thinking?
Okay. Well, I mean, I think Mexico is definitely a city with a Mexico City. I think it's has a very rich tradition, where art has historically had an important place. You know, I consider myself to be from this city. Like, I think the nation is a very abstract thing that I have issues with. But I do definitely inhabit this city, and the city has a very rich tradition artists are taken very seriously here, and there's a very vibrant and complex scene. And as artists, we are not isolated. In many ways, we are a result of our environment. Mm-hmm. So growing up and living in this city has definitely had a big, big positive influence, I think, in my practice. In terms of the reception of my work, nowadays, contemporary art is highly globalized. We don't work in a specific location. You know, my production and my exhibitions take place in many different parts of the world. Yeah. And I think that's why my practice has been shaped for such a context. You know, in other words, I generally try to address issues that are common for most people,
yeah,
as well as issues that are very specific to the areas where the pieces are produced. But I don't think art can be or even has to attempt to be universal. And if some people don't get it, I think that's fine. You know, I have no problems with that.
This is a side question, but...
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure you're a soccer fan, right?
I like watching soccer, and I played when I was a kid a lot.
Okay.
I'm not a fanatic. I mean, I enjoy it, but most of my friends are.
They're like soccer zealots.
Not at all. No.
No? Oh, okay.
But I like watching sometimes. Like I said, most of my friends are real fans. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I end up watching the games with them a lot.
That's good. To go back to what you were about to say about Mexico as, I guess, part of like an identity, is nationalism important to the understanding of your work? And how do you think that fields such as, you know, political science, cultural anthropology, and literature, which we touched briefly in your introduction and also in the question about liminal spaces, how do these, you know, other fields figure into your work? First part is nationalism. Second part is, you know, anything like that art can sort of, absorb into the practice.
Yeah. Okay. In terms of nationalism, I am not sure if it's important to understanding my work, but I definitely, you know, nationalism is one of the topics I'm really interested in, and I've addressed it a lot in a lot of my works. And actually, now I am making a piece in Arizona for the ASU Museum in Phoenix, which is a piece that will open. A solo exhibition that will open July 2nd, this coming July 2nd,
okay.
Which is about nationalism in the U.S. So that's a topic that interests me a lot. I am generally highly critical of nationalism, and to me it's kind of crazy that after what happened in Europe in the first half of the 20th century, where the dangers of this ideology became so evident, that it's still such a predominant ideology in our days. Especially, you know, in this transnational era in which, you know, economy, you know, technology and so many other aspects of our life and culture do not respect borders at all.
Yeah.
So this new piece, it's called Oracle.
Okay.
And Oracle is the name of a town in Arizona where big protest took place last year. But also it's a reference to Oracle Corporation.
Mm.
And it's also a reference of this, corporate government complicity. Because Oracle Corporation started being as a CIA kind of making software for the CIA.
Yeah, they're kind, so of, like kind a, of a they're kind of like the Rand Corporation.
Exactly.
Like
so
the
this
technology
kind of
side
division of you know, private corporations and government is where it's really completely diluted, and there's, it's hard to distinguish one from the other, which is the exact opposite to nationalism, you know. So I am really interested on how these two different paradigms kind of coexist and this kind of all the side effects that this double standard carries.
Yeah.
So this town in Arizona last year there were last year in the U.S. Over 60,000 unaccompanied children from Central America arrived. Yeah. I don't know if you heard about this.
No, that's kind of amazing.
So what happened is that a lot of, the government was completely overwhelmed, and a lot of these kids were sent to detention centers in different parts.
Yeah, just like barracks with beds and stuff like that.
Yeah, kind of temporarily while they figured out what to do. So there is one of such places in this town in Oracle, and a lot of these kids were sent there. So at the same time, this town is a stronghold for the Arizona Border Protectors, which is kind of what the Minutemen used to be. So they orchestrated a very big protest against the kids being brought there.
Yeah.
So when the museum invited me to produce a piece and to make an exhibition there, I kind of thought back at this, what happened last year, and then I've been focusing around there. So what I did is I contacted the members of this, Arizona Border Protectors, and I, asked them to remake the protest for my cameras. And I shot a whole bunch of other videos as well. I also shot a video with the kids.
Yeah.
Which are basically, I did a cover version of the Marines hymn.
Yeah.
But changing the lyrics to the kids basically singing their own story in the U.S. invasion in Guatemala. So the idea behind the piece is that most of the discrimination of immigrants that takes place in the U.S., it's not as it is commonly believed, based in race. I mean, it's not racism, but that the root instead is nationalism. Nationalism as a cause for discrimination.
Yeah.
So I have done some projects that deal with immigration in the U.S. And one of the reasons why I'm interested in this issue is because of how deeply shocked I am of the fact that foreign policy is hardly ever addressed when discussing immigration.
Right.
I think nationalism creates the illusion that we live in a kind of contained, isolated bubble that is completely sealed from the outside.
Right.
So that tends to make conversations always be contained within that bubble and lose perspective. But reality doesn't work that way. In reality, borders are always porous, and we are all interconnected, especially in this age, where economy is completely globalized and many other aspects of our system. That's more or less what this piece is about. I'm kind of trying to focus on the root causes for as to why these kids go to the U.S. in the first place. Like I mentioned, the U.S. invaded all the countries from where these kids are coming from. And that kind of issues are not addressed, so that creates a very limited and unbalanced understanding of the phenomenon.
And as far as the second part of the question goes,
yes.
Can you touch on that as well?
I think when I make art, I was once part of this great show called Amateurs. I mean, I think artists really, many artists dive into all these different aspects of our life and culture, so I do think that my work, is influenced and connected to political science, anthropology, literature. I mean, many of my works, are a direct result from what I read, and I don't only make art based on art. I mean, I make art based on my everyday life, but I also make art based on, anthropology or sociology or literature, philosophy, that I read. So I see a very strong relationship and connection.
Yeah, and I mean pedagogy is part of your practice because mm-hmm. you started Soma.
Yes.
Which is now like that is that you're not going to bring that back. Like, are you still doing that or?
Yeah, I definitely still teach for sure.
Yeah.
And I love teaching and I don't think teaching is making art. I mean, it's a different practice, but it's definitely one is informing the other, for sure.
Yeah. So you create a wide variety of media that isn't necessarily based off of producing objects. What do you feel about making objects? What do you feel about making objects? And do you apply that craftsman-like approach to making things that are objects to film and performance? I think this kind of has a connection to that bonus question I asked you about, are you a filmmaker? Do you consider yourself a filmmaker? Mm-hmm. And if no, then why not? You know, and if yes, then how so?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of craftsmanship involved in making, you know, the film installations that I do. You know, for instance, the editing process is very craft-oriented. But you know, I've always been interested in making you know immersive environments as opposed to yeah. objects. You know, I kind of like the public to engage, and for me, it is much easier to achieve that by creating environments as opposed to objects. But I think, like I said, you know, making these environments, I don't think that does not leave craftsmanship, you know, out of the equation, you know.
Yeah, I was watching mm-hmm. one of your pieces in which you collaborated with Raymond Pettibon.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I forget how many channels you employed.
It's a six channel piece.
Uh-huh. Right, right. So you know, you're literally walking into the work. Mm-hmm. And you know that's not something that filmmakers approach making work.
Yeah,
you know, it's usually mm-hmm. usually just like a single channel.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But you have you sort of like the liberty to use the space how you want because people aren't just sitting down and facing forward.
Yeah, and I think one of the aspects that I like about the gallery kind of format is that it can be immersive, you know, and I like that. You kind of enter a space as opposed to watching from a distance, like in film. So I like that, and so that's why, you know, I think my practice is very hybrid. I think I come from film, but I also come from performance, and come from installation, and you know, the language I've kind of developed kind of blends of these different traditions. So, I mean, I do definitely come from experimental film and documentary film to a big extent, but not exclusively.
Yeah, yeah. And can you, I mean, I'm really sort of amazed by not just the performances that the people in your videos give, but mm-hmm. by the varying types of performances. You have like some that are like close to method acting, mm-hmm. others that are just random, you know, volunteers, participants, and then others, you know, they are the same exact people that are reenacting the very thing that people that I'm sorry, I'm kind of like confusing myself here because it's kind of complicated. It's kind of complicated.
Yes. It's
like somebody, you know, let's say, just to give an example, like robs a store and then you go and ask them to reenact that robbery and then you document mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the degrees of fictionalization vary. from work to work. I mean, it's not always the same degree, and kind of balance between, you know, artificiality and documentary, so to speak, can change from one piece to the other. But generally, the like I said, you know, before when I was talking about the this liminal space between fiction and reality, generally there is this kind of equation happening, and there's this kind of tension being created. But of course, to different degrees, you know, when you ask somebody to reenact a robbery, even if they try to reenact it in a, you know, in a perfect way, there is going to be fiction. You know, it's not the robbery in itself. So you're already entering the realm of fiction, and it's already an artificial situation. So I kind of play with this and to varying degrees from work to work.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of runs throughout all the... I watched all the Vidmeo videos that you posted. And, you know, like, what is it that is so, you know, different than, you know, just watching, like, a document of what happened, you know? And why is that important? You know, like... What is this that you're actually watching, and is it something that allows you to distance yourself from the actual event so that you can sort of, I don't know, assess it better? Is there like a certain re-articulation that makes it an artwork, and because it's an artwork, you kind of read it in the context, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the art world or the, I mean, the art environment, I mean, it's just an environment that, you know, gives us the space and the time to think about things that probably we would not think about. But I think, you know, any document already is in the realm of fiction to a degree. In other words, you know, a document, it's not reality in itself. So you're already entering the realm of fiction to even if it is to a small extent, but you are. So, but I think, you know, in general, you know, a lot of documentation creates the illusion that it is its reality in itself. So, I mean, what I try to do my, you know, in my works is to make works that are highly, you know, self-reflexive in works in which you're very much aware of the fact that it's not reality that you are watching, but and that kind of the work points to its own artificiality in order for us to like I said, you know, in an earlier question, gain some distance from reality and can reflect on it.
We have time for maybe one or two more questions, and I think that'll.
Okay.
I think we've exhausted our list.
Okay. yeah, there was a last question you sent me, right?
Yeah, it was. What is your model as far as aesthetic sensibilities go? Are there artists, both living or deceased, whose work you have a close relationship with? And I think we mentioned some collaborations too. So
yes, yeah, of course. I mean, I think there are many. I mean, like I said before, I my work does not only gets inspired in art, but I definitely there are many artists and thinkers that have that I admire very much and that have influenced me very much. So I don't know, people that come into my mind are like people like Pier Paolo Pasolini.
Yeah.
Who has influenced me a lot. Siqueiros can be another example here. Or, you know, Californian artists that I really like from, you know, 70s, 80s that I really admire, like, you know, Bruce Conner, for instance, or Chris Burden, who was my teacher at UCLA.
Yeah, rest in peace. Yeah. So you think that... there is a certain kind of aesthetic to this art that isn't, you know, based in this modernist formalist approach.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's so much their aesthetic.
It's not like written down on, I mean, it's not like absolutely written down on stone or anything like that.
Yeah. But I don't think it's so much their aesthetic that influenced me. It's more their attitude that I think influenced me. Of all these artists I just mentioned, you know, I think they're all incredibly free and playful and you know, I think their kind of attitude is what influenced me more than the actual aesthetic that, you know.
Sure.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Sure. I mean, Pier Paolo Pasolini, he was a director he's one of the few directors besides, let's say, the French New Wave directors that wrote about their films. And he wrote very eloquently.
He was a poet, besides being a filmmaker, or before being a filmmaker, he was a poet, and he also wrote a lot of, you know, political essays, and wrote a lot about his own work, or other people's work, yeah.
Is that something that you do as part of your practice as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think Pasolini, besides making films or writing poetry, he was also an activist, and I also consider myself to parallel to making art, to also being kind of engaged in activism, and I think he's highly influential, and he's kind of he's incredibly complex, and he kind of operates in many different levels, and I'm very much influenced by that.
Great. I think we've got no time left for our show.
Wow, the hour went by really fast.
Yeah. We started with a discussion about Italian city names, and we ended off on an Italian director. So I think that makes for a good conclusion.
Yeah, from Roma. So it's perfect.
Yeah. You know, if you were here in the studio, I would invite you down to, you know, Chinatown for a bowl of pho. But since you're in Mexico City, we'll have to...
You're making me very sad now. Because I love Vietnamese food. But I will be in LA at the end of this month. So I'll
take me up on that.
Exactly, I'll take you up.
Awesome. Awesome.
Great.
Okay, thank you so much, Joshua. And I hope, you know, your show in July, what is it?
July 2nd. I wanted it to be the 4th of July, but the museum is closed, so we're doing it July 2nd.
Yeah, and you'll be there too for the...
And I'll be there, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'll be there, but before going there, I'm going to LA, so... but yes, I will be there July 2nd. So anybody that wants to take the trip to Arizona, I'll be happy to see you there.
All right. And would you like to shout out or plug anything else before we sign off?
No, nothing else comes to my mind.
All right.
Now only the pho is in my mind.
It's a fog of pho in your mind.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Joshua. Thank you. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
All right.
All right.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
And there you go. We are about to send you guys off to Never Never Land. This has been I think the sixth or seventh edition of Drawn to Scale. I'm Sun. The next show is in, what's next month? July? And it's going to be with Joshua Astor and Kristen Calabrese. All right, guys. Peace out.